Today, Trance Warp Stimulus. The DFA Daily to the 4th of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Given that we've been releasing daily updates this week, much of the news has already been covered, so this will be a shorter show, just covering the latest events. And I want to start with the basic question. When an investor makes an investment decision, do you think that they should be insulated from the consequences of the decisions when the markets turn down? For example, should the government stand behind property investors who piled in on the expectations of future capital growth and tax breaks when it seems neither now is certain? And how about commercial property investors or those with funds invested in superannuation? At some point, we have to let investors take the hit, take the risk. Or else you're back to the old adage that privatising the profits is fine, but socialise the losses. And that is where we are now, with more and more business sectors clamouring for government bailouts on the basis that the current health crisis was totally an unknowable event. Well, sorry, but this was one of a number of risks which were on the table. In fact, I've been running war games events for corporates for years, and when I do, I include a health-related risk scenario. Often boards failed miserably to deal with it, by the way, as it is too far from their form of reality. And by the way, this is not just an Australian phenomenon. As Bloomberg points out, in the US, non-bank financial firms spent years lobbying against tougher regulation and stricter capital requirements, arguing that their emerging dominance in mortgage lending didn't pose a risk to the financial system. Yet now, many of those companies say that they're in desperate need of a bailout to stave off bankruptcy and a potential collapse of the US housing market. Any rescue might not come quickly as regulators are holding off on providing additional help to see if policies already put in place ease the industry's expected cash crunch. That could lead to anxious moments for people like Quicken Loans, Freedom Mortgage, Mr. Cooper Group, and other non-bank mortgage firms. Now, federal mortgage watchdogs didn't predict a pandemic grinding the economy to a halt, but many of them did see a potential non-bank liquidity crisis coming, and their efforts to impose more safeguards ran aground against industry resistance and bureaucratic reticence to slow the fastest growing source of US home loans. When government-owned Ginnie Mae tried to require stress tests and higher capital and liquidity requirements, some non-banks were violently opposed to the idea, said former Ginnie President Michael Bright. One small lender told Bright that if an event similar to the proposed stress scenario were to take place, he'd just hand Ginnie the keys to his firm. And the rise for non-banks in the mortgage sector, and now their pain, shows the shaky ground on which much of the post-crisis financial world has been built. Shadow lending has soared, with firms outside the oversight of the Federal Reserve and other regulators helping to fuel a decade-long credit boom. These companies lack access to many of the government subsidies and funding sources that make banks more stable. Mortgage services, Mr. Cooper, PennyMac Financial Services, and Ocwen Financial Corporation all slipped on Friday in New York. Cooper plunged 19% to 551, while PennyMac slid 5.9% to 1685, and Ocwen declined 13% to 33 cents. While the 2008 housing crash was caused by risky mortgages and fraud, the 2020 crisis isn't the result of bad decisions by lenders. Loads of workers have lost jobs as a result of the health issue, putting their ability to make loan payments at risk. That point hit home on Thursday when the Labor Department reported that a record 6.6 million Americans applied for unemployment benefits last week. As part of the $2 trillion stimulus bill passed in March, Congress mandated that mortgage servicers allow borrowers to delay payments on government-backed loans for as long as a year. And Moody's Analytics chief economist estimates that roughly 15 million households, or about 30% of Americans with home loans, could miss payments if the economy remains dormant through the summer or longer. Under agreements with Ginnie, Fannie Mae, and Freddie Mac, servicers themselves must advance the money when borrowers postpone payments, and it can take months before they're reimbursed. Congress didn't provide explicit funding to help services with that problem. And some of the companies say that they don't have the liquidity to handle it themselves. But Mortgage Bankers Association Senior Vice President Pete Mills says it's unfair to punish non-banks for being unprepared for a calamity like the health issue because it couldn't have been predicted. I don't think there is a liquidity standard that could have dealt with this kind of ramp-up in expected delayed payments, says Mills, whose Washington-based group lobbies for the industry. Should services start to go under, federal agencies will have to rush to find other companies to take over the loans. Borrowers could have more difficulty working with their mortgage companies on loan modifications to alleviate some of the pain of the current crisis. Others will have fewer places to go to find new loans. If not solved, the epicenter of the non-bank crisis will be with Ginnie, which is part of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. The company guarantees $2.1 trillion in mortgage bonds containing loans to low-wealth borrowers, veterans, and others. While non-banks service about two-thirds of all mortgages, they handle nearly 9 out of 10 mortgages backed by Ginnie, according to the Urban Institute Housing Finance Policy Center. After the financial crisis, large banks like JP Morgan Chase and Bank of America severely reduced the number of loans that they were willing to make under Ginnie-sponsored programs. Mortgage lending was less profitable than other business lines, and some banks stayed clear because they were scarred by government penalties for alleged fraud. As the banks retreated, Quicken Loans, Freedom Mortgage, Mr. Cooper Group, and others filled the void. Non-bank share of new mortgages has risen to 66% of the market from 40% in 2013, according to the Urban Institute. Freedom Chief Executive Officer Stan Middleman said most non-banks could last several months without additional government support, but that a liquidity facility would still be needed as a safety net if the crisis drags on beyond half a year. He said housing is too important to the economy for Washington to not intervene, adding that the severity of pain that the health issue has created is unprecedented. This is not like a flood in Missouri, Middleman said. This is everywhere, all at once. Over the past few years, academics and government regulators have sounded alarms that non-banks don't have the capital or liquidity to stand an economic downturn. A 2018 paper by researchers at the Fed and the University of California, Berkeley warned that the non-bank mortgage sector appears to have minimal resources to bring to bear in a stress scenario. The MBA, the industry trade group, released its own white paper in 2019, calling the researchers' warnings overstated. And in December, the Financial Stability Oversight Council said non-banks were a potential source of danger, a warning met with derision by some non-bank mortgage firms. When it comes to loan services, the FSOC and regulators have spent years fretting about supposed hazards that do not really exist, Freedom's Middleman wrote in a January post on the MBA website. He said FSOC's contention that non-bank services were a systemic risk was bizarre, though he did write that the government could help non-banks find more stable sources of liquidity. But while regulators seemed well aware of the potential issues, little was done to fix them. In 2017 and 2018, Ginnie required some of its largest lenders to present liquidity plans showing what lines of credit and capital they could draw on in a crisis. While some non-banks appeared strong, others had credit lines that could be pulled by their lenders at any time for any reason, said Bright, making them poor funding sources during a downturn. And Ginny also asked lenders to subject themselves to stress tests using a hypothetical economic calamity, much less severe than the one being experienced today. With the bulk of its services facing a cash crunch, Ginny late last month said it would activate a disaster relief program that lets services apply to have Ginny advance payments to bondholders itself, but that program won't cover other parts of a mortgage payment, such as taxes, insurance, and homeowners association payments. Now, non-bank mortgage firms say that many of them will go under if they don't get a new lending facility from the Treasury Department and Fed. And former Ginny President Ted Tozer, who was appointed by President Barack Obama, said the health issue shows that non-banks need a lender of last resort in the same way that banks are able to draw on the Fed in times of peril. We need to find a solution so we're not going through this every time we have some sort of a crisis, Tozer said. Now, over in Europe, we hear that European Union officials are looking at further accounting measures to help the banking sector deal with the health crisis, but also that they are keeping their powder dry for now. In a draft statement, they said that they stand ready to take further actions to mitigate the health impact, including possible additional non-legislative or legislative measures. For now, though, legal changes like softening the impact of new accounting rules don't appear necessary. And locally, as the Financial Standard reported, another industry superfund has reduced the value of its unlisted assets as the impact of the health issues worsen. Host Plus has devalued assets within its property and infrastructure portfolios by a range of 7.5 to 10% depending on the individual investment and the age of its most recent independent valuation. The fund's private equity and venture capital investments have also been devalued for similar considerations by 15% on average. The news comes after Australian Super and UniSuper both devalued their unlisted assets last week. And it's been a tough time for super funds, who have also had hundreds of billions wiped from their books in the share market volatility. In a letter, Host Plus reassured its members and investors that it is doing everything it can in the current circumstances. We are actively monitoring these unprecedented circumstances to ensure that your hard-earned retirement savings continue to be well managed, Host Plus said. In doing so, it is our duty and our objective to ensure that we do everything possible to ensure that all members and investors are treated equitably during these extraordinary times. And the fund said that, and while the full economic effects will not be fully understood for some time, it is clear certain infrastructure and property assets such as airports, toll roads, and shopping centres have been materially affected by the current crisis. As a result, and taken as a broad category of assets, Host Plus unlisted investments would expectedly and realistically experience lower valuations in the current climate than they would ordinarily have had prior to the emergence of the current risks a few short months ago, Host Plus said. With this in mind, we have worked closely with our investment managers and asset consultants to determine appropriate impacts on the valuations of these unlisted assets so as to ensure that these assets are measured and appropriate for the current circumstances. And Host Plus said that while asset devaluations are being experienced across all sectors of the economy, the current decreases in valuations for its own unlisted asset investments are in fact less extreme compared to the current heightened volatility in listed markets. It is that long-term price stability, which is a key positive attribute to our strategic investments in unlisted assets, the fund said. These revaluations have already been included in the fund's unit pricing and are reflected in account balances, Host Plus said. Along with its professional asset managers and asset consultant, it will continue to monitor investment markets closely to ensure the pricing of its unlisted assets remain appropriate for the circumstances as they evolve and to ensure that all asset values reflect fair value across all account balances. And the current health episode is a crisis like no other, says the IMF on their blog. The success of the pace of recovery, they say, will depend crucially on policies undertaken during the crisis. It feels like a war, they said, and in many ways it is. People are dying. Medical professionals are on the front lines. And those in essential services, food distribution, delivery and public utilities, work overtime to support the effort. And then there are the hidden soldiers, those who fight the health issues confined in their homes and able to fully contribute to production. In a war, massive spending on armament stimulates economic activity and special provisions ensure essential services. In this crisis, things are more complicated, but a common feature is an increased role for the public sector. At the risk of oversimplifying, policy needs to be distinguished in two phases. The first phase is the war. Things are in full swing to save people's lives. Mitigation measures are severely curtailing economic activity. This may be expected to last one or two quarters, they say. And the second phase is the post-war recovery. The health issue will be under control with vaccines or drugs, partial herd immunity, and continued but less disruptive containment measures. As restrictions are lifted, the economies return, perhaps haltingly, to normal functioning. The success of the pace of recovery will depend crucially on policies undertaken during the crisis. If policies ensure that workers do not lose their jobs, renters and homeowners are not evicted, companies avoid bankruptcy, and businesses and trade networks are preserved, the recovery will occur sooner and more smoothly. This, they say, is a major challenge for advanced economies whose governments can easily finance an extraordinary increase in expenditures even as their revenues are dropping. The challenge is even greater, however, for low-income and emerging economies that face capital flight. They will require grants and financing from the global community, which, by the way, will be a focus on a subsequent IMF blog. Promoting the recovery will have its own challenges, including higher levels of public debt and possibly new sways of the economy under government control. But relative success in phase one will ensure that economic policy can go back to its normal operation. Fiscal measures to boost demand will become increasingly effective as more people are allowed to leave their homes and go back to work. Interest rates and inflation were projected to be low for long prior to the current episode in most advanced economies. Preventing major disruptions in supply chains should avoid inflation during the emergency and recovery phases. If the measures to contain the spread are successful, the unnecessary increase in the public debt ratio will have been sizable, but interest rates and aggregate demand are likely to remain low in the recovery phase. Under these circumstances, fiscal stimulus will be appropriate and highly effective in most advanced economies. And this will facilitate exit from the exceptional measures introduced during the crisis. Now that, of course, sounds quite simple on paper, but I think the reality will be rather different. And it's been another good week for the US dollar. The greenback traded higher against all of the major currencies on Friday, despite abysmal non-farm payroll numbers. According to the latest report, the hemorrhaging in the labour market started before any state issued stay-at-home orders. In the first 2 weeks of March, US businesses shed 701,000 jobs. That's 700% more than economists anticipated. While everyone believes that millions of jobs have been cut in the past few weeks, no one expected such a shockingly large number this early. The leisure and hospitality industry accounted for more than half of the job losses as businesses began to cancel conferences and meetings in late February. The unemployment rate jumped to 4.4% as the household survey reported a 3 million decrease in employment. Everyone is looking for data to worsen. If March payrolls were this bad, one can only imagine how ugly the April figures will be. We could be looking at non-farm payrolls falling by the millions, according to Jobless Claims. Approximately 10 million people filed for unemployment benefits at the end of March. The whole country did not go into full lockdown until the middle of the month. And with the president extending federal distancing guidelines through to the end of this month, more Americans will be out of work for longer. We don't expect to see the true extent on the US economy until next month. And sterling got sold off on Friday on the back of weak purchasing indices. The services sector index dropped to 34.5 from 35.7, while the composite index fell to 36 from 37.1. The manufacturing index hasn't seen such a big decline, but it's only a matter of time before it will. The UK will most certainly be one of the countries hit the hardest. It's number 8 on the list now for confirmed cases. And the euro-US dollar extends its slide for the fifth straight day on downwardly revised purchasing manager indices. The Australian and New Zealand dollar also extended their slide. Australia's construction PMI index fell further, while the services and composite reports were revised lower. Investors shrugged off the increase in retail sales, as spending will certainly contract in March and April, although it will be impossible for Australia's economy to recover before the rest of the world. There's early evidence that the country's curve is flattening and the RBA meets next week. And while no changes are expected, the central bank's dovish bias will remain intact. And oil prices surged by around a third after President Trump tweeted about a possible agreement between Saudi Arabia and Russia to reduce output by 10 million barrels or more. But these tweets were not confirmed, and as of the 1st of April, the Saudis and Iraq have indicated that they're going to boost output. Although there are some reasons to be sceptical and the price of May WTI pulled back from a high of nearly $27 to almost $24 before the close, the odds of something taking place have perceived to have risen somewhat, and OPEC has invited other oil producers to a virtual meeting on Monday. Trump has rejected the idea that US producers should participate in the production cuts. And locally, there was more bad news for property. Based on a confidential leaked document which listed 15 Melbourne properties with faulty cladding that will get taxpayer-funded repairs, but they are also riddled with other construction problems. Inspections indicate that more than two decades of lax regulation have left buildings with a range of fire safety issues that must be addressed to make them safe to live in. Opposition planning spokesman Tim Smith said the additional defects on the buildings show that the government's Victorian Building Authority had for years allowed a culture where some builders and surveyors got away with substandard work or unsafe design. These examples of dodgy practitioners and works show how bad building regulation has been. Last year, the Victorian government promised $600 million to fix the most dangerous buildings. A state government task force identified 432 extreme or high-risk buildings in need of repair. The list of the first 15 buildings to be fixed has been kept secret by the government until now. And Charles Bazin from building consultants Roscom said the builders and surveyors in the first 15 needing repairs should have been suspended. The report, created for the government as part of the process of establishing its new agency Cladding Safety Victoria, was meant to remain confidential because many owners of the buildings didn't want their addresses published due to the impact on their property values. And talking of property values, CoreLogic's property index is still pushing higher, though, at a slowing rate. And many now expect a significant reversal. The question, of course, will be whether property transactions continue at all and what lower volumes might mean. As you know, we continue to expect price falls ahead. And so now we're going to briefly cover the final market movements from Friday, but if you want the Australian detail, then we already cover that in yesterday's update. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 1.69% on Friday to 21,052. The S&P 500 fell 0.51% to 2,488. And the Financial Services Index fell 2.23% to 325.95. The Volatility Index was down 8.07% to 46.80. The Nasdaq fell 1.53% to 7,373. The 10-year bond was up 1.77% to 0.599, and the 3-month was up 0.75% to 0.106. The US dollar index was up 0.5 to 100.58. Across to the UK, the FTSE was down 1.18% to 5,415, and the pound US dollar was down 0.98% to 1.226. The Shanghai Composite was down 0.6% to 2,763, and gold was down 0.88% to 1,645, while WTI oil was up 14.42% to 2834, and Bitcoin was down 2.94% to 6,745. And finally, looking ahead, the S&P 500 futures was down 1.45% to 2,482. And the NASDAQ futures were down 1.37% to 7,522. And finally, before we go, we'll be running another event and question and answer session live soon. Our normal slot is the third Tuesday of the month, which will be the 21st of April. But my question to you is based on feedback from a number of viewers. Would you appreciate a live Q&A session sooner? So let me know in the comments below. If there's sufficient interest, I could run something perhaps next week or the week after. After all, there is certainly plenty to talk about at the moment. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.